Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer John Kurzweg. But first, let's talk about some news from the last week in the world of music. And the big thing is that the major record labels are about to renegotiate their license agreements with YouTube. Now, why is that such a big deal? Well, right now, YouTube pays the least of any streaming service. Yeah, that's right. If you have songs on YouTube, you're getting paid a whole lot less than you are on just about any other service that you can think of. Obviously, that's not good for business. Nobody likes it, especially the major record labels. But here's the problem. Usually, major record labels are all powerful and they can get their way with just about anything in any negotiation. And they've done that with other streaming services to the point where they've even gotten equity from these services. So in other words, they basically say, you've got to pay us a ton of money up front, and then you have to pay us a pretty good royalty rate on the back end. Oh, and by the way, we want 10% of your business in order to give you the license. They can't do this with YouTube. And one of the reasons why is because of all the user-generated content. Because if a label pulls their license from YouTube and basically says, you can no longer have our official music videos, it doesn't matter, because the next day what will happen is all of a sudden those songs that were taken down, there'll be 150 user-generated videos of that music to take their place. So it's kind of an idle threat. And actually, what ended up happening was Warner Brothers did this a few years ago, and they basically said, okay, we're not going to give you a license. Well, YouTube basically shrugged their shoulders and said, no problem. And they went on about their business, and a year later, Warner's came back and wanted to sign a deal with them. The reason why, for a whole year, the Warner catalog was still on YouTube, and they didn't get a penny from it. So the idea was, we'd be better off getting at least a little money rather than no money at all. So don't expect a lot to happen in this ongoing negotiation. Now, some of these licenses have run out and others are about to. We don't know which ones are which, but the fact of the matter is pretty soon all three major labels will not have a license with YouTube. Now, what the major labels would really like would be, instead of the advertising revenue that they're getting, not only from YouTube, but from Spotify and from Pandora and just about every other services, this is on the free tier, by the way, what they would prefer is to have a paid subscriber tier. And YouTube has tried to do that with their YouTube Red service. But the fact of the matter is, it really hasn't caught on. And you can tell because you haven't heard a thing about it since it came out in October. So as a result, all of the money that's coming in, virtually all the money, is still on this advertising tier. And what that means is the copyright owner, which is the record label in this case, in most cases actually, is getting 55% of the income, as compared to 70% or more from every other streaming service. So you can see why this is a very sore point with the record labels. However, it looks like they just don't have any leverage do anything about it, which is quite unusual for a major label. So let's see how that goes, and maybe there'll be something that will come up that we don't know about, but looks like it's going to be a losing battle for the major record labels for once. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks coaching program, as well as some of my other online coaching programs. You can go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. The next thing that I spotted this week was the fact that Gibson is in trouble. Yes, it's no longer Gibson guitars. In fact, it's now Gibson brands. And that's because a few years ago, Gibson decided it was going to diversify out of the music business and basically got into consumer electronics. So this started by buying Onkyo, the hi-fi audio company, and then a little while after that, it bought Teac. Now, last year, it bought a company called Wooz, W-O-O-Z. This is a consumer electronic accessories company out of Singapore, and they paid a ton of money for it. And as a result, they're in a little bit of a financial bind, so much so that Moody's has downgraded their credit to junk status, which is as low as it will go. And Moody's gave three reasons for this. The first was the very poor reception that Gibson got from its 2015 guitar line. They came out with a lot of models that the dealers and the public were just not interested in. As a result, it affected their sales. Sales just weren't there as usual. So that was one strike against them. The second strike was the fact that they've had an ongoing management revolving door, and this is especially on the financial side of Gibson. And anytime there's instability like that, the ratings companies freak out a little bit. So that's what's happening there. That's number two. And number three was the fact that they branched into consumer electronics, which is filled with much, much deeper pockets than Gibson has. So when you're going up against the likes of Sony and Apple, that's a really tough go. So as a result, Moody has downgraded their credit rating to junk status. Now, to make it even worse, Gibson has about $100 million worth of loans that it has to pay over the next 22 months. And it doesn't have enough money. So what they did this past week is put two of their Nashville warehouses up for sale. And that's really what started this whole thing off, because once you see these warehouses in prime real estate now, in really great areas of Nashville, once you see that happening, then you begin to think, well, wait a second, there has to be a reason why they're doing it, and this is why. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. So not good for Gibson. It doesn't mean they're going to fail. Doesn't mean it's going to go out of business, but it is something to keep your eye on, especially if you're a Gibson guitar lover. My guest today is producer, engineer, musician John Kurzweg, who's produced giant albums for Creed, Puddle of Mud, as well as Godsmack, Jewel, Big Head Todd and the Monsters, and many, many more. His productions have sold more than 40 million albums and have resulted in 12 number one singles on rock radio and another 8 top 10 hits. I spoke with John from a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico. One of the coolest things I read about you was the fact that your first guitar teacher told you to give up.
It's true. He really did. He said that if I should probably play bass or just stop. And it was because he felt my fingers were too short, amongst other things that he probably wasn't telling me. I don't know what, but...
That's amazing. I mean, first of all, you just don't hear guitar teachers doing that. And I don't know. I think it's kind of against the instructor etiquette or something to do that. But it's cool that you didn't stop. In fact, you took it the other way. And it sounds like you really got into it from there.
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky that, I took lessons from that particular person at a music store in Richmond, Virginia. And one day I came in, and he was no longer there. And so they hooked me up with a new guy. And that guy was really cool and really supportive and always like, what do you want to learn? And oh, I'll show you that, you know? And at the time I thought that playing lead guitar was like my heroes of the day, like Joe Walsh or Jimmy Page or Santana or Mark Farner or whoever. I thought that humans couldn't really do that. That was just only like for the mere gods, and so he asked me what I wanted to do. And I was like, well, I'd like to play lead guitar like these guys. He said, oh, well, I'll show you how to do that. And he did. He started, and he got me also, he did an interesting thing with me. I remember saying, I think we were learning, the solo to a song called Sin's a Good Man's Brother by Grand Funk, which was one of my favorite guitar solos at that time. And he was showing me the first half of it. And then he said, okay, your assignment is to go home and learn the rest of it. Wow. Learn the rest of it? How? He said, by just listening to the record.
Wow.
How? You'll figure, he goes, just listen to the record. You'll start to figure out, just listen over and over the record. And so that forced me to go home and pick up the needle and drop it back a minute and keep picking up the needle and dropping it back. And and then with my fingers trying to find those notes. And that was a huge, that changed everything because I started to develop somewhat of an ear, and then I could, and I don't know if he knew that was going to happen or what, but it changed everything. So,
Well, that's what we all do, but it's great that there's actually a guiding force that helped you do that. That was awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And then after a year with that guy, he sent me to a jazz guitar teacher because he said there wasn't a whole lot more he could show me, he felt. So he graduated me to a jazz guy. And that was, I was 13 at the time. And then I didn't listen to jazz. So that was a whole nother weird world to me.
Were you resistant to doing that?
No, what I didn't know what to think of it at first. And so this gentleman was quite a bit older than me. I actually went online to look for him the other day, and I guess he's passed away now. His name was Jerry Fields. He actually taught quite a few people. I was going online looking at a lot of like successful jazz guitarists today that say Jerry Fields was my teacher. It's kind of interesting. So I was with this guy for a year, but what he did with me that was brilliant was he said, you know, do you know Joe Pass or Charlie Christian or Barney Hill? He named these names at me that I'd never heard before. I didn't, I was like, no, I don't listen to them. I listened to the Allman Brothers and the James Gang or whatever it was I was listening to at the time. And he didn't know any of that stuff. So what he did do was he sat down and played, some of what he could do on the guitar. And it was so mind blowing to me, just the approach and the scales and the speed and the melodicism of, it was the harmonic complexity that I had never gotten anywhere near before. So it was, and he played for a few minutes and then looked at me and said, would you like to learn some of that? And of course I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's cool because that sets you up for later years then.
Yeah. I mean, it a lot happened for me around that time of 13, 14. I started to also, with the Allman Brothers and things like that, there were these harmony guitar parts happening. So to train my ear too, one of the funny things I would do, even with maybe a solo like Stairway to Heaven or something like that, when I play along and, I'm going to learn Stairway to Heaven exactly the way that is, and so I do that. Well, now on the fly, I'm going to try to play a harmony to it.
Wow.
To the record while it's playing. Well, I'll get all kinds of odd, strange things as a teenager. but they did develop my ear, and you start also learning, well, that note doesn't work against that chord.
Yeah.
And things like that, that were kind of interesting. Okay, that note works okay until it gets to the third chord, and then that doesn't, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did you get to Tallahassee then?
Well, my father was a Lutheran minister, and he's retired now, but he, so we traveled all over when I was a kid, and he was a musician too. Like music actually was his first thing. He was a pianist and taught vocals. And it was funny, he didn't play, but he was totally an amazing sight reader, which I'm the opposite of that. I can read, but not a good sight reader. So we moved around. I think we lived in Virginia for about 9 years, and then he got transferred to a church. He took a job at a church in Tallahassee, Florida. So, and I think I was just turning 14 when we moved. Literally like a week or two before my birthday, I think, when we moved.
The reason why I bring it up is Tallahassee seems like, at least at the time, it was a very active music scene.
In some ways. And certainly the school there, FSU and FAMU, two universities. I'll tell you what doesn't get probably talked about much was the high school I went to, Leon High School, had a great band director and music program. And he was so, the band director's name was Lewis Jones. Anyway, I was in high school band. I actually played flute in high school band. And then I because it's, Jeff Hart, Paul, Marsh Tucker, and Genesis, and all these bands had flute back then. So why don't I play flute? So, and then I played guitar in the jazz band. And you know, it was cool to have band directors that were like, and a part of it were like about accuracy, about knowing something about music and knowing dynamics and getting into music more, just kind of like they took it very seriously and challenged me. Like I had no idea, for instance, that I rushed, you know, like, 'cause I thought I was kind of a hot shot on the flute and on guitar because I could play all these Jethro Tull licks or whatever. And then the band director's like going, yeah, but can you play it in time? Mm. And can you make a groove? And can you not get in front of the drums? You know, and,
yeah.
And I'm 14 and 15 and somebody's challenging me with this stuff. So, you know, because when you're that age, you're usually not thinking about that. You're not thinking about making something groove or playing in time. You just want to play as fast as you possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Again, good training for later when you become a producer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I got very fascinated around that time in high school about how the instruments fit together. And I will also tell you that going back to when I was 11 and starting guitar, and I'd already played piano. My parents made me take piano when I was about 7 or 8 or something. And I had this mistaken belief. But, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a rock star, probably like a lot of people that want to play guitar and sing. I wanted to be a rock star. And I thought to be the leader of a band like Steppenwolf or whoever my heroes were at the time, but you had to know everything about music and know how all the instruments fit together,
mm-hmm.
and know exactly what was happening everywhere in the song with all the instruments. I thought that the actual rock stars were, you know, were like that. And so I thought, well, I need to be like that. I need to know what the drums are doing and how they work and how the bass works and how the keyboards, you know, it just, it's funny to me now because I realize actually very few rock stars know that stuff and nor do they care.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean that in a bad way. Like they're going to write the songs and sing them and do what they're going to do. And that's enough, you know, like to do a great job of that. It's like, no, that's the producer, like, you know, that's your job as a producer. You figure out what's going wrong between the bass and the drums.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. 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 But you're already predisposed to that, you know, when you're a kid.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. As I got into high school, I did. And I wanted to know about it, you know, like I wanted to. I think it fascinated me that our band director in high school could play all these different instruments really well,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that he really understood how everything fit together. And he could look at the part, he could listen, you know, he'd know when a section was not right. And I think that fascinated me. I think in some way I wanted to like be like that. I wanted to like, okay, I need to know how all this stuff works together.
How did you get to your solo record? Were you in a band that was signed prior to that, or how did that work?
Well, I had a lot of different bands when I was in Tallahassee, and eventually I had a band that toured around in the early 80s, and I was really trying to get a record deal. And then eventually that band broke up. I think it was like 80. I had some demos that I had done with them and also by myself. And I had a 4-track by this time. I think I bought my first 4-track in 1981. It was a first Porta studio that came out. So I was learning how to record myself and produce myself also. And I finally got signed a guy named Frankie LaRocca that was the drummer for a while with Brian Adams and John Waite. And some other people too. He was now A&R at Atlantic Records, and he got a hold of some of my demos, and so it was signed in 85, I think, and then we started on my record in 86. And you know, that was like all I cared about in my 20s was getting a record deal and doing a record.
Yeah.
And that was the whole focus of everything that I was doing, was getting to that place. But, you know, the funny thing with getting to that place, you don't realize that there's all these other things that I should have been thinking about even beyond that I wasn't thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's sort of typical, though, isn't it?
Probably so. But, you know, like I had never really put a lot of thought into what would happen, like after the record came out, or what, you know, what I was going to do then, or what. So, and I also didn't have a band at the time, which made things a little difficult. So,
what was that experience like making the record? Where did you make it at? Were you in New York or in LA?
We started the record in Suffern, New York, at it used to belong, maybe it's still one, to Spira Gyra, the jazz rock band.
Yeah,
they had a studio in Suffern that was called, I want to say it was called Bear Tracks.
Yes, I think you're right.
I think that was what it, and is a great studio, really wonderful studio. And I was lucky enough to, at the time, of record producers that I was aware of, a guy named Ken Scott was my top of the list. I mean, I just loved every record that guy ever had anything to do with. And it turned out that he liked my demos, and we were able to, you know, work it out to work together. So we started the record in, you know, up there. And then we also went out to LA to work at a studio that he liked that was called Total Access. I think we did like 2 weeks out there.
Okay, wait a second. Wait, so you're working with Ken Scott, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Ken Scott's also a friend of mine, and actually we co-wrote a book together, his memoirs. So I know him very well.
Larry had mentioned that. Larry had mentioned that, which is amazing. Like, Liz, there aren't very many people I meet that actually, well, a lot know who he is, but most people don't know him or have had it. Yeah. So yeah. That in itself was a thing. I was so excited to see, you know, because his name kind of disappeared for a little while. And then it resurfaced, and now, like, everybody knows who he is again, which is great, because he totally serves that.
Yeah,
the guy
yeah.
is among the best of the best. And I mean, all you have to do is go listen. The best thing you do is just go listen to a record
yeah.
that you worked on or did, yeah. you know? And it's like, how did that, you know, climb of the century, to
yeah.
me,
yeah.
is, for me, beyond Dark Side of the Moon. Like, everybody talks about Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. And I go, no, Supertramp, Crime of the Century.
Yeah.
Check that out.
Yeah,
like, if you want to listen to a record from the same, similar time period, it will blow you away production-wise. That record, to me, is just amazing.
Well, I'll take this another step. I just recorded a Total Access in December. So it's
wow.
a small world.
So it's still there. Does Wynn,
yes.
was it Wynn Davies? Wynn. Is he still there?
Yes. He still owns it. Yes.
Oh, that's great. That's amazing. Well, tell them I said hi if you speak with them anytime. So that's amazing. Yeah, that was 1986. It was the summer of 86. I was there for 2 weeks. And the assistant there later joined, I think, Great White.
Yes.
And went on to produce them too, I think.
Yes, that's
Michael
right.
Michael, I forget Michael's last name.
Yeah. I can't think of it either.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Small
okay,
world.
So you recorded there, and then what happened?
Well, it's kind of a hard thing to talk about, and I've only gotten to speak once with Ken since then. Ken Scott and I were a lot alike. And probably too much alike. We're both perfectionists. We don't move quickly. And I don't mean that in a negative way. Like, there are producers that move really fast in the studio that are just like, bam, 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 let's just blow through this and that's good enough. And Ken is not like that. He's not a that's good enough guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's wanting something to be great and be as good as possible and sound as good. And I'm the same way. So what I think happened was having two people together that were too much alike, and it slowed the process down even more. So that after 6 weeks, we didn't have a whole lot done. And my manager sat down with me and the label and were like, look, you know, we need to like change course here somehow. And, we decided, and I ultimately the decision was with me. So really, I should take responsibility. Just decided to not use Ken anymore and to go back and use one of my mentors from Florida who I'd learned a lot of producing from and had done a lot of my demos, a guy named Dana Cornock, who sonically was actually very similar to Ken, and Ken Scott was one of his heroes also.
Yeah.
So I think for him, it was amazing for him to actually get to work on a 24-track reels that Ken Scott had actually started.
Yeah.
Because I think with Ken, we finished one song completely, mixed and everything, and then all the other songs were, say, 50 to 60% done, you know, tracked.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot left to do. There were a lot of vocals and overdubs left to do, but the basics were all done. And they were amazingly good basics. And one of the hard things was that we went back to Ken and said, okay, you know, we want to credit you with this one song that came out great, that he did it. He produced and mixed and did the whole thing of 100% Ken Scott production. And then we want to give you co-production credit on the other ones. And he didn't want to have his name even on the record at that point, because he said, I think his managers probably said, let me listen to it. And then they came back and said, Ken doesn't want to be involved with it. So we actually had to take his name off the record. And we didn't really talk for, 20 years or something probably after that. And then I think it was about 10 years ago, I got to speak with him just for a few minutes on the phone. But he didn't really, I wanted to try to make whatever kind of amends or talk through whatever might could be talked through, but he didn't seem like he wanted to do that at that point. I will say this too, I should say this, that in 1986, when I was doing my record, I was drinking excessively. And since then I've gotten sober and I don't do any of that. And I was a handful. I would not want to have produced me. So I, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Ken took on an artist that I don't think it was very fun working with me at the time. You know, I was a handful.
Oh, I'll have to get you a copy of the book. And I think it'll give you some more insight into that period.
I would love to. And the man, I mean, I still have utter respect for the man. He so good at what he does, and he's such a gentleman, and he's so intelligent, and he's very funny too. I got to say, he was quite funny in the studio at times.
Yeah.
I still quote him at times, like little funny things that he would say in the studio, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So how did you get from there to being the producer that you are? What was the path?
Well, what happened was the record came, when we finally got the record out of my record, you know, it did okay for about 6 weeks or so, and then it just vanished. And we, you know, my manager and I kind of ran out of money and da-da-da-da, and I was broke. I didn't have a band. I'd played a few dates as a solo acoustic, and next thing I know, I'm like, I got to go back to Florida and just start working again, because it just didn't work out, you know. And so I moved back to Florida, Tallahassee, and then I think Jacksonville for a year. And I had my 8-track. At this time, I had a Fostex 8-track reel-to-reel. I was still just producing myself. So for another 2 years, I think I just only recorded myself. And then in 1989, I think I had moved back to Tallahassee, and I got a call from a friend of mine who said, I've got a, you know, one of these college indie bands over here. And I don't think I'm the right guy for them. And I think you should bring your 8-track over here to my place, because they're all ready to go. And he knew how kind of quickly it was easy to move the 8-track, you know, it's just record these guys. And so I did. And they were called a Apopka Vineyard. They were just some young college students. None of them were professional musicians. You know, they were all like English majors and things like that that did music on the side. And they were of that kind of REM type thing that was happening at that time and had been happening for a while. So I did. I recorded them and I mixed it and I gave them a cassette. And the phone never stopped ringing after that. It was really that crazy. Wow. Like they went to the college station at FSU in Tallahassee and got that on the radio. I started hearing it on the radio and my phone started just ringing. All the local college bands wanted me to record them, or a lot of them, not all of them, but and so I just, that would be 89. And I just kept doing that and accumulating more gear, you know, okay, now I need a 16 track. Now I need some more mics. Now I need some real mic pre's, and also working at real studios too. Like some bands would hire me and say, we want you to come to Gainesville and work at a studio here, blah, blah, blah. So there were three or four real studios that I started to work in, which was a trip, you know, because like I was used to my little setup and my, like maybe I probably own six SM57 microphones and a Fossex 8-track, you know, like in the beginning, that's really how I did all my records, you know, all the little records. It was that simple. And then, so I started to get around some real gear and accumulate a little more real gear. And just, that just continues until 1996. A friend of mine who ran a club in Tallahassee and was also managing this band called Creed at the time. And he called me several times to produce them. And I went down and saw them, and I didn't really get it. At first, I did not get it. I just, you know, it was all not, you know, live in the clubs I was seeing them, and it didn't sound that good. It, you know, the mix wasn't that good, and maybe it was out of tune. The guitar might have been out of tune, and God knows what else was going on. And it's just like, no, you know, I don't know that I really want to work with this band. But finally, I gave in, and we started in June of 1996. And at that time, I had three ADATs. I think a Mackie board, and then maybe four real mic preamps and a few mics. And we did the first Creed record in my house in Tallahassee, Florida. So,
wow. How did you get your engineering chops together? Just by doing it?
Just by doing it. But I did mention the gentleman that I finished my album with, Dana Cornock, who he's still down in the Orlando area, I think. Florida. He had done some demos of me in real studios back in, say, 82, 83, 84, maybe 85. And he was great. He really knew engineering, and he had a very good ear and could mix really well. And he even knew the physics of sound. You know, so it was just very much a weakness of me. You know, like I'm not a guy that can look and go, God, we need to like put a baffle in that corner or something, or, you know, I'm not that guy. And he really understood the physics of sound and of the gear, and also had a good ear. So I would call him if I had a question, you know, like, how do you do acoustic guitar when you record acoustic, right? You know, and what do you do about this with the snare drum, or, you know, or I would call him when weird things would come up, especially like if I had to record a violin or something that wasn't on a regular basis. And I did learn a lot from those phone conversations with him. You know, he would go, well, you know, use this mic and point it this way. And but a lot of it was just doing it. A lot of it was just doing it, definitely.
What kind of monitors were you listening on at the time?
At the time, from 89 until about 94, 95, I used these tiny speakers that you could get at Radio Shack called Minimus 7.
Oh, yeah.
And, and Bob Claremont and other people swore by it. And I would EQ them. I would run them with a home stereo. I probably ran the high-end flat, but I would add low into them just to kind of make up. And I would listen to a CD that I knew, you know, like a CD that I trusted by somebody else, usually something mixed by Bob Clearmount or somebody. I would listen to that. And I would just kind of EQ the stereo to make it sound like, well, that sounds about right. And then I would literally produce on those speakers. And I had about four pairs of them because I'd blow them from time. You always needed extras because sometimes the kick drum would just take them out. And then I think somewhere in 95, 96, I got some Paradigms, the Canadian company. Yeah. I think they were called Mini Mark IIs. And they were great. I still have those. I don't use them anymore. I still have those. Those were wonderful speakers. Maybe a little tiny bit compressed, maybe not as much transients as some other speakers, but really a great, like from top to bottom, I just thought. And then I guess around 99, 2000, I mixed a Creed song at a studio that had Hassler. What are these? I'm still using them. I'm looking at them.
Oh, yes. I used to have a 5-1 setup of those, the Hassler monitors.
Oh, wow. The 5-1. Yeah. So I only own two. I'm just doing stereo, but there are the, I think, I'm looking for the model number of them.
Yeah, I don't remember.
TRM-8.
That's it.
And I've been using those, and I'll tell you, why, I mean, part of it is I've been using them so long that I know what they're supposed to sound like. But the thing that drew me to them in the beginning was at the time people were using Myers HD1s and then Genelex and things like that. And those are amazing speakers. But what I always found was that when I took the mixes home, they didn't sound as good as what I had done in the studio.
Yeah.
And with these Hasslers, they never made anything sound better than it really was, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, perfect.
And so when I would take the mixes home, they would either sound the same or a little better. And I thought, man, that's what I need. I need something that isn't fooling me and making it sound better than it really is.
Mm-hmm.
Or some people would say it's not fooling you, it's giving you what's really there. But then I would argue, yeah, but does everybody have a stereo like that?
Yeah, right. Well, it's working for you, so however it works, it's fine. After that first Creed record then, okay, so that blows up. Then what happens?
Let me back up to during the record, and then that'll... So after they got signed, and this little record that I'd done in my house got them signed, and then the label, just they found that it had been done on ADAPS. They didn't like that, so they wanted us to re-record some or doctor it up or run it to tape. What we ended up doing was doing a little bit of editing, I think down at Criteria in Miami. We went, they wanted to spend some money on the record. So they put us down. We went down to Criteria and we edited a few songs and maybe I think we bounced them to tape. And I remember one day I had to make a rough mix of where we were at for one of the label people. And I was doing that and the assistant just started staring at the speakers and he got really quiet. And I looked at the assistant and I said, "What's the matter? Is something sounding wrong?" Said, "No." I go, "Well, what's the matter?" He goes, and he turned to me and he said to me, he said, "A year from now, your whole life is going to be so different and you're never going to speak to me again." He really heard that. And I said, "What do you mean? What do you mean? What are you talking about?" I literally was that, and I didn't know what he was talking about. And he said, "This is going to be huge. This record is going to be huge." And I didn't know that. I'd already done a lot of really good records. I knew it was good, but I did not know. But he was right. I mean, I did speak to him again. He was wrong about that. I did speak to him again, but he was right. My whole life, a year later, and 2 years later especially, was completely different. You know, I guess once you have a successful record, the phone rings, and So it was almost a continuation, I guess, of what had happened in 89 with the college indie band. It was just a bigger version of that. Like, all of a sudden there's actually budgets and money and studios and bands that you've heard of. I think it really didn't change, though. I will say it didn't change in a big way for me until I had done the second Creed record. And when that did really well, I think maybe everybody went, oh, okay, it's not a fluke.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then the phone really started ringing, and it did a few records of some really good bands around that time, but nothing happened until, I guess it was, I'm going to say nothing, I'm like, I didn't have any other success for a while until Puddle of Mud. I think we started on that record in 2000. Yeah. Yeah. And then when they did really well, again, the phone kept ringing.
Yeah.
I was lucky for a while.
When you you're producing somebody, are you engineering as well? Are you engineering the tracking especially, or are you bringing somebody else in now? How does that work for you?
I'm doing all the engineering, or 90% of it. There was a period during the second Puddle of Mud record where I tried to bring in some other people so that I wouldn't have to do that. I thought it would help. But for some reason, the way I'm wired, it didn't really work well. And fortunately, another producer friend of mine had to kind of make it okay for me to, like, I thought I was doing something wrong by doing all of it. You know, like, I was like, well, man, I need to be more like Rick Rubin or whoever, you know, name who, like, I need to get other people doing the engineering. And so somebody else that was doing a record in the same studio I was doing it just said, no, man, it's totally okay. You know, like, if it works better for you turning the knobs and doing the producing, then do both. So I've got to kind of, went back to that. And I always, you know, there were always assistants. I had one assistant for a long time, assistant engineer named Bobby Silvaggio, who lives in LA now. And he does a lot of sound for movies and stuff now. And he's a really good engineer, and I should have used him more, but I didn't. But he did a lot of, he would helped me with a lot of Pro Tools things at the time. So we could, like, work on two things at once and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. When you're tracking, then I guess it must be easier for you than to do two things at the same time, because, you know, there's the engineering hat that you're wearing and you're thinking all about the sound. And then there's a producer's hat that you're wearing that you're thinking more about the performances. And I know some people, and I'm like that myself, I have a hard time doing both at the same time. Ken Scott can do it very well. And obviously you can. I always wonder, wow, how does that work? You know?
Well, there is, for me, I will admit, it does raise the stress level, because to do both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I still would have, if I wish that I had maybe found someone, or probably, you know, like, again, I didn't really discover how good Bobby was till the very, like, after the end of near the end of our period of working together on some of the bigger records. I wish I'd kind of handed over more to him, because I think he would have done a good job. I wish I'd had some, because it is stressful to do both, because I am definitely, I'm listening not only to the arrangement of the general arrangement of the song, like, okay, is this right, having these two bars here before we jump into the bridge, or is it okay, the guitar solo's eight bars, or could that be six or four? I'm listening to that, but I'm also listening to the parts, right? Which mm-hmm. is, you know, like, is the kick drum part right?
Yeah.
Is the, you know, is it okay that he's opening his hi-hat there and then going, I'm listening to all that, and do I have the right microphone up? Did I just get an overload on channel 3?
Yeah.
You know, it's stressful. I mean, I totally get why producers have engineers that just, it's like, that's their worry now. You know, like, you watch the meters and you make sure it sounds great. I think that's a really good way to work. There's something about the way my brain works, though, like, where if you take away the engineering, it did not necessarily help me to only focus on the arrangement and the parts. It's almost like I need to be stressing about all three things. Mm. Or something.
Yeah. No, I get it. Do you have your own studio, or do you just work wherever is convenient?
I do have my own studio in Santa Fe here in New Mexico that I'm working in right now. And it actually is on property that a long time ago belonged to Glenn Frey of the Eagles.
Oh, yeah.
Although the studio wasn't here at that time. And so I'm using that. I also, when people, you know, I'll work anywhere that, and I'm also very good at, I mean, the studio that I have here in Santa Fe is actually half house, half studio. It's only used as studio. No one lives in it, but it is kind of just, I got so used to doing records in houses. I kind of like that. I like having windows.
Yeah.
One of the things I don't like about professional studios is they don't have windows, and it kind of drives me crazy.
Yeah.
So, and I'm very used to doing records in houses or even at warehouses. I mean, back in the early 90s, I would even sometimes go to a band's rehearsal warehouse and track the drums and bass there. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. then take it to my place to do the rest of stuff or whatever. So it's, I'm not one of those guys that, like, I have to have a pristine, amazing studio to do stuff in.
Do you have a lot of gear?
I do. And I probably sold about a third of it, I don't know, 8 years ago or 7 years, but I do. I'm in the room right now with it. I have a whole lot of Neve microphones and APIs, and oh gosh, I sold some of my GMLs. I still have some GML, Tupac, Telefunken. I do. I have way more gear than I need. That's one reason I sold. I kind of woke up, and you know, when you're doing big records and the money's coming in and you're in your heyday or whatever, and you know, and it's all going well. You know, it's like, well, I need more mic pre's. I need more compressor, you know, one day you get home and maybe you don't work as much a particular year. And then you look around and you look at your racks and you go, what am I doing with all this stuff? I don't even use half of it.
Yeah. Right. I'm curious, when I listen to the records that you've worked on, you tend to like a drier sound. The effects that you use are very subtle. Am I wrong?
No, that's pretty true. I mean, in the 80s, when I was producing myself and then when other people were doing me, we totally, of course, I mean, I got very versed in using lexicons on drums and lots of delays and lots of chorus. But yeah, somewhere in the 90s, I remember, you know, I have to credit, it goes back to like the first Black Crowes record when that came out. And it just jumped out of the radio different than anything that had been on the radio for a while. And really, in a way, the big Nirvana record also did that. You know, it's not totally dry, but Nevermind was drier than a lot of things that had been out for a while. And it took me back to when I was a kid, maybe like 71, 73-ish, of like, there's effects there, you know, but there's more band and sound than there is effect. Whereas I think in the 80s, we got used to like the effects being just as loud as the original signal.
Yeah.
And I love effects. I actually love a lot of stuff from the 80s, actually. I love a lot of this. But you're right, I do. And I also kind of like, you know, maybe going back to Ken Scott, like if you listen to some of his records, Sometimes there are delays in the background that you don't readily hear right away. Maybe the first time you hear the song, it might be the second or third listen you realize that there's a delay on the vocal or on the guitar in the background, maybe panned over to the left side or something. And I kind of dig that approach. I don't, you know,
yeah.
It's one of the things I miss in when I listen to the radio now. Like when I hear, not everything, but a lot of stuff on the radio now, like everything is loud. It just sounds like every single instrument and vocal is front and center and in your face.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Everything is loud. And there's nothing in the background. And I kind of, you know, to me, effects could be one of the things that's in the background. But you're right. I actually had to struggle with Creed on the second record about that. They wanted so much reverb on everything. And one needs to remember, we were mixing that record in 1999. And I was like, why do you want all this reverb on here? Like, let's, you know, and so we compromised. And it ended up being pretty dry. Mm-hmm. I mean, we definitely used reverb. There's reverb going on the drums and vocals and things, but not a lot. Because I just didn't think that was appropriate at the time either for what they were doing or what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how subtle you're going to be with it. And now, you mentioned that you listen to the radio, and it seems like we've come full circle, where for a while everything was kind of dry and in your face, and now we're coming back to the big washy reverbs and everything again. It's way different.
Which is kind of fun. Kind of fun to hear some of that.
yeah. Oh, yeah, it is. And I certainly like that. But, you know, it's interesting how the trends work. And we tend to follow them all the time, or maybe are forced to. I don't know.
I think another thing about, I can trace it back to Steppenwolf records, James Gang records that I was listening to as a kid. One album might be dry, and then the next record might be really kind of wet, like mm-hmm. they bought a reverb unit or something. And for as a kid, not knowing names of things or what it was, not knowing anything about sound, I notice now that the records I preferred were always a little bit drier.
Mm-hmm.
That as a kid, there was something about reverb that I didn't like as much. And then that's a blanket statement. It's not totally, it doesn't apply to, but I do know that there's something about those slightly drier records that I really enjoyed.
Then you have the fact that a lot of times the reverbs were EQ'd or filtered in such a way where there was no top end and not a lot of bottom end, so it kind of blended into the track.
Totally. Another problem I have, it's a weakness of mine, is I think one of the reasons I don't like a lot of reverb is that, one, I rarely find one I like the sound of,
mm-hmm.
and two, I may not actually know how to filter a plate quite the way some, let's talk about like maybe some of the U2 records from the 80s and on that have beautiful reverbs on the vocal and you know, just drenched, and it's beautiful and it works great and it sounds great, and like it may just be that I don't know how to do that quite that good, you know what I mean, like maybe I never, you know, because I do hear reverbs from time to time on vocals and on drumming that are drenched, and I go, you know what, that sounds great.
Yeah, yeah.
I just, you know, like if I could pick that guy's brain, if I could call Daniel Lenoir right now and go, what reverb was that and how did you filter it?
Well, to me, what kind of changed everything is when I found out how they did it at Abbey Road. And on all of their plates, they had a filter set. They had an EMI filter set that cut everything off at 600 cycles on the bottom and 10K at the top, and sometimes down to 8K. And when I found that out, it kind of made a big difference. And then also sometimes there was a scoop at like 2K where the vocal sits. And again, you have those particular frequencies dialed in, and all of a sudden you can add so much reverb and you don't notice it. It blends in, kind of glues everything together, and it's, you know, just so nice. It's very cool. It made a difference for me anyway.
Well, I know in the 80s that Dana Cornock, when I was working with him, he would always EQ the effects returns. Delays, he would make really thin. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to help. And then, like, if we had a snare drum, you know, and this was the day of the big gated snare, he would totally find some weird mid-range frequency that really made the reverb jump out in a way. And so, it was kind of a trip to, like, to watch that and ask questions about that. Like, yeah. Wow, you're EQing the effects.
Yeah. Right. Where a lot of people don't think about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What's amazing about that, I'll tell you something amazing. I was lucky on the first Puddle of Mud record that Andy Wallace, I remember the label and the band said, well, you know, we might want someone else to mix this record. And I was like, well, I'm not going to be into that unless it's like one of three people. And they said, well, we're thinking Andy Wallace. And that was like my first. And then I said, okay, absolutely. I said, you know, if you're going to get Andy Wallace to mix, can I go and watch him for a day or two?
Yeah.
Which I did. And he does not EQ his effects.
Really?
No. Now, of course, some of his effects have EQs built into them, you know, like on his rack, like you get like some of his special effects and delays. I think they had like, you know, built in EQs in the actual effect, but he does know because we talked about that. I remember looking at the board, the SSL he was working on. And I noticed this, I said, you don't EQ any of your, and he said, no, I don't, you know, I don't need to. Why would I do that? But again, like whatever reverbs he was pulling up from the Eventides and the Lexicons and things like that, I think he probably already had some roll offs and things like that already built in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I bet that was fun watching him. I wish I could do that myself.
The biggest thing it taught me, and you have to understand, I'm as insecure as anyone you would probably ever meet in doing this, is that I always, for some reason, thought I was probably doing things wrong and inferior in some way. Mm-hmm. And the coolest thing was watching him. He says, okay, I've been working on this mix all day. Let me play it for you. And he hits play. Of course, the moving faders start moving because it's an SSL. I think it was a G. And he let me, you know, I was able to, as the song was running down, I'm looking at the board, I'm looking at his EQs, I'm looking at the compressors, I'm watching the faders, and I'm going, in my mind, I'm going, this is 70 to 80%. At least exactly what I was doing on the rough mix back in LA. Mm-hmm. Like it was so close to what I was doing and how he did, like in like the way the drums would jump up the chorus and the reverbs would jump up and the way he wrote things. And most of it was very similar to how, and I realized, okay, maybe I'm okay.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you need that verification, you know, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. I certainly did.
Yeah. Last question for you, John, and thanks for spending so much time with me. What is the best piece of business advice that you either received by someone or you learned along the way?
Oh my God. That is a great question and a hard one for me, being that I don't consider myself a very good business person at times. I look back. You know what I've lacked a lot of my life, and now that I'm trying to get better at it, I think would be maybe what comes to me in this moment. I might answer it differently tomorrow or the next day.
Yeah.
Would maybe be know your worth. Try to be right-sized about things, and hopefully, you know, there's a lot of ego in the industry too, and certainly I've had my dose of that, and you know that I've got my own version of that. But a lot of times I've had certain people that have had to say that they've noticed they've like may have recognized in me that at certain times I didn't know my worth or what I was good at. And then again, also like what I wasn't good at, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers the question. Certainly having a good attorney is going to help, and things like that. I've always tried to, trust that if I do good work, I'm going to get taken care of and things are going to go okay. That doesn't always work out that way, but I think mostly it has for me, or at least maybe more than 50% of the time that's worked. Mm-hmm. But I'm not always the wisest when it comes to business stuff.
Well, hey, let's face it. It's difficult, especially when you spend all of your life on the other side where you're just being creative and that's all you think about. And then all of a sudden you're thrust into this other part of the business that, you know, you care less about, obviously, than the creative part. So it's difficult for everybody, I think.
I think there's definitely a part of me that still wants to walk out of the room and turn off when business starts. You know, like, you're right, like, there's a part of me that's I'm so not interested in that part.
Yeah.
I kind of don't want to, you know, so it's hard for me to stay engaged with that and be an adult and take care of myself and make sure everybody gets taken care of.
Yeah, you
know?
Yeah.
That's adult stuff, you know. it's grown up stuff, and yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, definitely. Well, John, thank you so much for your time. This is very enjoyable talking to you, and I don't want to take too much of your time up, but I could have asked you a lot more questions, and I'm sure we would be talking for a long time more, but I don't want to abuse your schedule here. So thanks so much for spending the time that you have so far. It's been great.
Same here, Bobby. Thank you so much, and we'll do it again then.
All right, John. You can find out more about John by going to his website at johnkurzweg.com, JohnKurzweg. That's all one word, johnkurzweg.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Thank you, Steve, for helping put the show together. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it in iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time